Today is Thursday. It's December 8th, 2016. This is John Williams, and we are the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast that you can hear broadcast in part on my Saturday afternoon show at 1:30 on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN, where we play absolutely none of this podcast.
I'm Kristen McQuarrie, a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
I'm Eric Zorn, the erudite columnist from the Tribune, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays, where you will read things that come up in this podcast.
Funny, he still brings around an old paper thesaurus.
Oh, erudite, for instance?
Right. Yeah.
Do you guys remember Joe the Plumber? Now meet Chuck the Steelworker. Chuck Jones, president of the United Steelworkers Union Local 1999, today is saying that Donald Trump did not do enough for his members at that Carrier plant in Indiana. You made a promise to keep all these jobs. You have delivered, he told CNN Money in an interview yesterday. We expect you to go back and keep all the jobs. Jones added that Trump should also helped 350 workers at an Indianapolis plant owned by another company, which are slated to move to Mexico. They are also members at that plant of his union local. The president-elect fired back via Twitter. Chuck Jones, who is president of the United Steelworkers 1999, has done a terrible job representing workers. No wonder companies flee the country, Trump wrote. And he also said, if United Steelworkers 1999 was any good, they would have kept those jobs in Indiana, spend more time working, less time talking, reduce dues.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, I always love those
talk about
exclamation
punching,
points.
Talk about punching down. For goodness sake, he's the president-elect, and he's whacking at a local union leader.
Eric, I thought that when he became president, he wouldn't have to fight off everything. But he still can't take anything. It's remarkable, isn't it?
Well, remarkable is one word for it. It's kind of frightening, too, isn't it?
I think the frightening part can be seen with what happened with Boeing this week, because the Tribune was involved, right, as far as we know. The president-elect tweets out early in the morning, I think on Tuesday, that the Boeing is being paid too much for the new Air Force Ones, $4 billion. He went down into the lobby of Trump Tower and accused them of doing a number on the U.S. And come to find out, while those numbers are probably exaggerated, they also apparently the complaint was prompted not by what he thought about the spending, but by the fact that the CEO of Boeing had been published in the Tribune an hour before criticizing Trump for his China policies.
Yeah, well, he is now saying that he didn't know about that when he issued this. Can I just read it? He did it at 5:56 in the morning, which is really one of his best hours. Boeing is building a brand new 747 Air Force One for future presidents, but costs are out of control. More than $4 billion. Cancel order.
Well, all right. So
cancel order.
There should be a book of just the last
apologize.
Two words of each tweet.
Sad.
What I think, I don't know that he that soon. You know, I'd like to think the Tribune is that, you know, visible that he saw this and then he reacted. I don't know. But Boeing does get a lot of corporate welfare out of taxpayers. They got paid lots and lots of money to build the Dreamliner. They get lots of contracts. They do have terrible cost overruns. We just keep paying them. So I think, again, this anti-corporate welfare message resonates with his people. We don't even put these things out to bid. Boeing gets whatever it wants. The Dreamliner, by the way, was like 4 years behind schedule, billions of dollars over cost, and then when they finally got it up in the air, the batteries kept catching on fire.
Well,
how
would you describe what he did, though, to keep Carrier in Indiana, then?
I don't like it. I mean,
inconsistent, then, based on what you just said?
No, I think it's corporate welfare.
Yeah, well,
that's what I'm saying.
That's my point. Okay.
Can I just say two quick things? I brought up the Tribune connection because it seems to be what prompted his flag-burning tweet last week. Those tweets came right after a Fox News story about flag burning at a campus. So that, and the other thing about, he wasn't talking about corporate welfare in general. It was sort of vindictive against one company that seemed to have ticked him off. And that's what I think is
It could be
worthy of attention.
But Boeing does need to be reined in. They get kinds of taxpayer-funded
I think that Kristen makes a good point, which is, you know, when we focus on exactly what Trump is talking about and exactly these deals he's talking about, we're missing the larger point, which is the message that's being delivered to people out there. It's like in the carrier situation. And Phil Kadner, who's a mutual friend of mine and Kristen's, has a column in the Sun-Times this morning, saying, and he's a basically a liberal Democratic guy, wouldn't you say, Kristen?
Oh,
politics,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Saying, you know, what Trump is doing is his message here is that he cares about these working people and that he cares about what's going on to the American working class, and that's the message that's getting through, and that when we correctly and accurately nitpick that deal as, you know, governments picking winners and losers, these massive subsidies, these you know, whatever's going on, the possible military contracts that are going along with carrier's agreement to stay here, we're missing the broader point, the broader message that he's delivering. And which is just that he cares about these people, and he's angry about this. He's going to do something about it. And years and years of government policy has been like, well, not much we can do about this. You know, people work for less overseas, and you know, you get to buy cheaper stuff at Walmart. Don't worry about it. And the same thing with corporate welfare. Like, yeah, well, Boeing has these cost overruns and these big things. But don't worry about it. You know, just don't you worry yourself about it. This is the message that's getting through, and like I say, I am all behind the criticism of this carrier deal. I think that the Boeing, I mean, there's a million ways you can slice that Boeing critique.
But they're inconsistent, right, Eric? Because the Boeing deal, he said, no, the government's giving too much money to that private company. They need to shore it up. And then what does he do for carrier but give them government or have Indiana, you know, force Indiana to do his bidding and give money to carrier?
They are inconsistent in exactly the way you outlined, but they're consistent.
And if his idea is to work for the common man, how does then him picking a fight, really joining a fight with the union boss there and saying, well, you guys are, the union's no good. I can't reconcile that.
That struck me as a real swing and a miss.
This is a beautiful thing about Donald Trump, because we're all arguing our own fights in many ways, because I brought up Boeing not because of him going after corporate welfare. I mean, I think the carrier thing was a big plus for the president-elect. I think politically that really worked. I started because we started with the union guy at carrier, and it was this punch down thing, the idea that the president-elect is going to come out personally, I think maybe in a vindictive way, about people who publicly criticize him. That's my approach to all of this. Not that it's good corporate welfare or bad politically or whatever. It's just kind of a remarkable thing.
Kristen, it's very Donald Trump, though.
Yeah,
it's
very Donald Trump.
It is. I think so. I don't think he's going to. I don't know whether he can continue to be on Twitter when he is officially inaugurated. We'll have to see. But this is his MO. This is his way of communicating with his base, is doing it through social media. I'm not saying it's smart or wise, but if you go after him, as this union official did, he's going to go after you.
But the common denominator is it's kind of this barstool wisdom. If you look at, there's an inconsistency, John, that you outlined very well, but the common denominator is, yeah, these corporations get too much welfare. Yeah, these companies are going overseas, and Donald Trump is doing something about it. That's the common denominator. And I know it doesn't stand up to all the scrutiny that we can apply to it, and that we should continue to apply to it, but that's the common denominator. And he is resonating, and you can see it in some of his poll numbers, which are surprisingly
I think you guys
rising.
Are writing for him when you bring up the corporate welfare thing in Boeing. I don't think that's what he was talking about. He wasn't saying we're giving them too many tax breaks or too many, you know, breaks one way or another.
Well,
he was just saying they're he said they're overcharging us.
Well, are you just interpreting a 140 character tweet? I mean, do you really think you know what he was trying to say? I think he was saying what lots of people who are fiscal conservatives have been saying about Boeing for decades, that they are getting all of these no-bid contracts. They are doing, you know, terrible cost overruns, and then producing a product like the case with the Dreamliner that's not even what they promised, and they get no scrutiny.
But no, the tweet wasn't about any of that. It was about the
cost overruns.
There are no cost overruns.
I'm going to read you the tweet. Boeing is building a brand new 747 Air Force One for future presidents, but costs are out of control. More than $4 billion. Cancel order.
Now, right. Boeing responds by saying the only contract they have is 107. Now, you can argue it's too much money, but it's $170 million sort of research and prepare contract. I think it's GAO said it was $2.6 billion over 10 years. They thought the cost for the program would be maybe the defense, someone said, was 3.3. No one's saying $4 billion, and there's no accusation of cost overruns on this project.
To me, he was speaking to the larger issue of corporate welfare, that if you read the Heritage Foundation and some of these other right-leaning, fiscally conservative, they've been writing about Boeing for two decades. And so to me, that's what he was referencing. And I don't like the carrier deal, but I understand the tough position that states are in. We do this in Illinois all the time. We have a separate agency whose job is basically to try to keep companies here and then give perks. We just passed a bailout for Exelon. You know, we can't solve our budget crisis, but Exelon got 4 days of full-time, around-the-clock attention from lawmakers for what was basically a corporate bailout.
I thought that was a clean air bill.
Everyone involved admits that it is somewhat of a bailout for Exelon to keep these two plants.
Well, they even say it out loud, don't they? To help the local communities.
Sure. Yeah. Illinois not do it? I mean, do we not offer Carrier $7 million in state tax breaks in order to keep them there? I don't know. I think that's a tougher position, but I don't necessarily think the Boeing issue that he talked about was totally out of line. It's consistent with the idea that this is a company that gets all kinds of attention from gets taxpayer money, and they deserve more scrutiny.
It's a good example that you know what's behind the issue in the bigger picture. I didn't and don't. I know what he tweeted, right? So we came away with two very different views of what he communicated.
Well, that's what you were saying too, right, Kristen? That you're interpreting a 140-character tweet, and maybe you're doing it wrong. So what's the resolution to that? This quandary we've talked ourselves into here.
I mean, Donald Trump needs to stop tweeting, but I also think we need to, the media jumps all over a 140-character tweet without maybe educating themselves a little bit about what he was possibly saying. I mean,
I'm in radio. I'm sitting at the anchor desk, and this happened, you know, when it happened. Donald Trump, the president-elect, tweets out that a Chicago company is doing a number on the United States. As a radio guy, I've been talking about this with people. What do I do? Because a lot of those tweets then, 6 hours later, turn out to be not wholly true, whether it's the $50 billion investment from the parent company of Sprint or the Boeing $4 billion. But if he tweets it and takes on someone, what would you suggest? I really am asking.
I don't either.
Leave it to the newspapers.
Eric Zorns of the world.
The new Trump speak
give
him
about 3 days, and I'll give you a think piece.
Maybe it's best to look at all Trump speak the way you would look at the thing about the flag. Does he really think that we should jail or revoke the citizenship of citizens who burn the flag? It's more, you know, we're all going to make a mistake, Steve, if we interpret what he said literally, which is a shame because that's how Americans work.
The alternative is to do it figuratively, and then we all come up with our own interpretation.
Well, have you listened to us for the last 10 minutes?
I know. That's not, I'm sorry, that's giving a bad communicator, and in times maybe a reckless communicator, a pass. It's like, well, you know how he is. No, if you're going to say these things and you're going to affect the market, it's not my fault for misunderstanding them. It's your fault for not communicating clearly.
I agree with you, and I don't like the idea that we need to rewrite the rules of journalism or talk radio or communication to accommodate him. I've listened to and read a lot about how people are trying to figure out what to do with this, and some of them are saying what I've suggested, don't take him literally, but others, including Maureen Ryan, for instance, she retweeted a piece that was on CNN, and it said, every single time we have to fight the truth, fight. Don't give any quarter. And if people get mad or if they don't care, that's okay. But you have to keep putting it out there. You'll lose your mind playing that whack-a-mole game if you're always trying to knock down every weird thing he says.
One thing that I've been finding myself experiencing as I look at as the news rolls out of the transition is this, I'm kind of overwhelmed by like these cabinet picks. Like he'll pick Ben Carson for HUD, who is admittedly, I mean, his people admit that he's incompetent, and he has no. He's a brain surgeon. He's never run anything in his life. He's going to run this massive and important organization or agency, and then he appoints Tom Price to head HHS, who's an ardent foe of abortion rights. Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, who's in Oklahoma. He's been suing the EPA for the last. I mean, this comes out day after day, and you get numb to it. And I just feel like, where do you start? Where do you begin to jump in on this and say? I just feel like the news is just.
I think you go back to Election Day and say he won. I mean, you know, people are saying, well, the Democrats now, they should have never invoked that nuclear option. You know, there's no filibuster for cabinet secretaries now. I'm glad there's not. He won. He gets to pick.
No. I'm not saying he doesn't have a right to pick. I'm just saying that these choices are confounding and troubling to me.
Well, are they like-minded, Eric? I mean, at least you see a thought pattern here.
Can you remember? Has anyone had a cabinet that's this right-wing, this hard
this inexperienced or this wealthy?
Can you even name who Obama's picks were for any of this? No, nobody got the type of scrutiny that Donald Trump is getting with these picks. And yes, they are really conservative. And again, this is what his vote he won, and this is what this should not be a surprise.
Except the EPA nominee doesn't really buy into climate change. I mean, that's frightening.
That is true, but he's also a states' rights person. So downsizing the EPA and giving states more control over their environmental policy is not such a bad thing.
Oh, boy, is it ever a bad thing.
It would be a great thing.
Remember that the P in EPA stands for protection. You know, this is a guy who's a coal advocate. I don't know how you can reconcile those two. How can you be for burning coal and fossil fuels but be an advocate as a protector of the environment?
Well, there states have very different environmental protection agencies. Ours is extremely weak. I would love to see our state environmental protection agency have a lot more teeth. They know where the landfills are. We just had a big piece in the Tribune about hog farms and all of the waste that they're spewing, and there's really nothing that the state-run EPA can do. I don't think it's a bad idea to empower state environmental protection agencies.
No, I don't either. All right, but Kristen, here's just the...
Steve's laughing at me over
No, I wasn't. I was still laughing at Eric saying, oh boy.
In Oklahoma, I mean, you know, the thing is you have these states that are run by these business interests, and they're going to just run roughshod over the environment out there. And so you're going to take that kind of approach and bring it nationally. I feel like, you know, it has been... you know, a long, hard struggle to protect the environment from the industrial interests in this country.
I mean, if your state, if you live in Texas, which has very little environmental regulation, which I don't agree with, you change your government. Okay. You change your governor. You make sure he appoints someone to head.
And if you live in Oklahoma or West Virginia, you put the interest of the economy over the interest of the environment.
If you live in Nevada and you are a state Nevada EPA or whatever the equivalent would be, you know, you are Nevadan, and clearly you're under the influence of the view from Nevada, which might not be the view from Virginia or Kentucky or Washington State. When it comes to national or world environmental issues, shouldn't the deciders be spread out a little bit from the sort of parochial interest? I mean, I'm just kind of asking.
It's the tragedy of the commons that'll play out.
No,
a minute. Are you saying his whole cabinet should be more diverse, or are you speaking about the EPA?
I'm saying that the choice. I mean, my broader point was that these choices. You've got a guy, the EPA guy, doesn't believe in protecting the environment. The woman he's put in charge of education doesn't believe in public education. I mean, you know, and this guy who's HHS
that's an
doesn't believe in.
But go ahead.
Both of those
point.
Were overstatements, but.
I know. Whatever.
No, well,
she believes in public education. She didn't send her kids there.
She believes in, well, she didn't
and
know.
The EPA
she didn't,
and
she didn't,
chief, and she, I'm not, I don't want to defend him because I haven't done enough research on him, but he believes in putting more power to the states. And, I mean, we have an EPA, a federal EPA right now that will go out and fine farmers for trying to, you know, put a pond in their own property or whatever. There is a big government aspect to the EPA that I think he wants to.
A ditch is a waterway and things like that.
Well, yes. Yeah. And just to your point about global policy, I agree with that. But we have different fracking policies in every state. And I support that. Illinois passed the toughest fracking regulation in the entire country after watching how other states had problems with fracking. We waited too long, and it's so restrictive, no one is fracking here, but we had the right to do that. And it was actually more the regulations for our fracking policy were stronger than what the federal government has in place.
But
so,
then when you've got these countries, these states that are run by libertarians and conservatives and these and the big business interests that are really in favor of fracking and no regulation on fracking, and they've also got the money to run these incredible political campaigns, too. We've seen the importance of money in political campaigns overall. It doesn't win every race, but it wins a lot of races. We've seen it in Illinois. So how are the
Democrats
so you're
spent
expecting
more
the,
here.
You're
I
expecting
mean,
the public to rise up.
Yes, I'm expecting
and
them
say,
to.
No, Oklahoma,
I'm supporting
you're not gonna...
the rights of states. And when they have had problems with fracking, for example, you're damn right that changed elections and people rose up and you had documentaries that emerged.
Where are they having all the earthquakes? Is that Oklahoma? Or is that,
it was Ohio a few years ago and Pennsylvania. And yes, the public responded because they didn't have fracking policies that were strong enough.
I always feel like there are more rascals in the state house than the Congress.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better.
No, but I do feel that way. I mean, going all the way back to Reagan and the new federalism, I felt like people, you know, fiefdoms and such could get away with more in state capitals where they weren't being watched as closely as Washington. You guys, is that wrong?
I don't know. I guess I just have a broader view that I think state policy impacts our lives a lot more than whoever's chosen to head the EPA. I mean, I just walked through the fracking thing with you. We have the state government and state agencies and what they do have more impact on our day-to-day lives than Pruitt will ever have.
Well,
I'm happy to be proven wrong at some point if he does.
Well, Steve Bertrand said Donald Trump won. So if the environment takes a back seat and suffers more in the next 4 years at the expense of the economy, that's a trade that a lot of people would say thumbs up. They do not have a problem with that. And it's his turn. It's their turn. God, the market's up for reasons that I cannot fathom. But if the economy improves and the market stays high and the environment suffers a little bit, Eric, that's a trade that people will applaud in advance.
Watch out for the market argument, because the market basically doubled under President Obama. So, you know, and people
well,
are saying,
it
well,
started
that,
at that, a very low point, too.
Well, it's higher than it's ever been, but okay.
Let's move on to what's happening in Illinois for just a second. Kristen, talk to us a little bit. You've been referencing Illinois politics and what goes on here. Talk to me a little bit about where we are in the budget impact.
Oh, do I have to? Eric, how about you, sir?
Eric wants you to.
No, Eric, do it. I'm so fed up. I can't.
Well, isn't part of the argument still that you can't have non-budgetary items in a budgetary conversation? Are we still debating that?
We are still debating that. And Kristen's about to say that budgetary items have all... Kristen and I have had this conversation on the radio, in print, and in the office so many times. That
but
I,
we really
I,
did I, even I could, miss you in your absence, even
do,
though
we do. I could actually... Sure. I could take Kristen... She could argue for me, and I could argue for her. We could do this perfectly well. But no, I mean, essentially what's gone on right now, I mean, yes, you're right. There's this long standoff about whether Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda items should be part of the budget negotiations. Democrats say no. Republicans want it to be that way. Right now, what seems to be going on is Republicans are telling the Democrats, we want to see your budget proposal. You know, but that seems to be the next step. And Governor Rauner said he doesn't want to meet anymore until the—am I right about this, Kristen? Is your understanding? They don't want to meet anymore until the Democrats come forward with some sort of budget proposal.
I mean, yes. The broader picture is nothing is going to get done until 2018. And I've come to that conclusion. We can talk about whether or not
18.
They should have
wow.
working groups to decide the budget, which is what they went back to this week. There is absolutely no trust between these groups, between Governor Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan and John Cullerton. And if you don't have a basic level of trust, you can't do anything. And both sides are to blame for that. So I don't see anything fixing our budget problems, our pension debt.
Boy, they should just throw in term limits in there, and then we'd get rid of these bums and these things would go through quicker, eh, Eric?
But you know, they wouldn't. I mean, I won't even take that bait. But let me. I mean, first of all, I think it is fine that we have a vote on term limits. I think that the Democrats should agree to that. I'm not sure that term limits would change much of anything. And I'll tell you that if they do enact term limits, it's not going to affect Mike Madigan because he's 74 years old right now, and they wouldn't go into effect probably for 10 years from now if they were to enact them. He's probably going to be retired by then. And in any case, our budget situation will be $500 billion in debt by if we wait for that to happen. So things have to happen. Speaker Madigan and the governor have got to figure out how to work this out. And Kristen is absolutely right. Everybody I talk to says there's no trust. The Democrats don't trust that if they give in. The Democrats tell me that I talked to, they say, well, if we give Rauner a couple of items and then we sit down and negotiate a budget and we'll agree to some tax hikes, then he's going to blame us for the tax hikes. And they've already started this BossMadigan.com website.
Well, they add members every day. Kennedy's the newest.
New people that they're going to go after. They're promising to go after in 2018. And everything points to a complete standoff until 2018. And we keep saying, we keep saying that the next election, after the next election, or this election will solve this, and then we'll be able to move forward. Or once the primary petitions are filed, then we'll be able to move forward. Nothing ever happens. And if Bruce Rauner is reelected in 2018, do we think anything's going to happen then? I mean, seriously, if the same basic dynamic is here, Rauner presumably is going to run for reelection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you said 2018, but do you really have any confidence that things would happen then?
No. That'll be an interesting year. Talk to me, guys, about Rahm Emanuel. Steve, you go first. He met with the president-elect. What did you make of either the optics of that or the potential substance of that? We don't know exactly what they said.
When he was leaving, he and other group of other mayors released this press release that they were presenting the president-elect with this letter to protect the DACA, the Dreamers, these kids who were brought into the country illegally by their parents and have grown now to make them be able to work and go to college and all of that. And just before that, at the same time, Time magazine released their Person of the Year interview where Donald Trump said, and this is where he tends to say things that people want to hear. He said, we're going to work something out on that and people are going to be happy and they're going to be proud.
Proud.
So, I mean, I think it's a pretty significant give if he is going to commit to protecting these Dreamers, because there are a lot in the Congress who don't like that executive order and wanted him to rescind it.
Here we go again, trying to interpret what that meant. But yeah, that's the vibe I got from it, too. So that was good for Rahm Emanuel. You know, I thought the Chicago Tribune story on it, though, kind of made it sound as though it was really a political play by the mayor for younger or Latino voters in the city. But I don't know that bothers me if it is, as if he does some good. Can I read to you guys the quote from Nancy Gibbs, the editor-in-chief at Time magazine, in announcing that Donald Trump was the person of the year? She said, Donald Trump is the person of the year, quote, for reminding America that demagoguery feeds on despair and that truth is only as powerful as the trust in those who speak it, and for empowering a hidden electorate by mainstreaming its furies and live streaming its fears.
That's a great honor.
Who said that, Eric?
No, that was Donald Trump. He actually,
he's in the room.
We have a button we push, and Donald Trump comes right into the conversation. Okay, so maybe that's enough about Trump and what happened with the mayor, unless somebody else wants to add something to that. By the way, can I just talk to you guys real quick about the Chicago Cubs? The Cubs
make it quick.
Poor Krista, man, you're just killing her.
The Cubs want to meet with with Barack Obama, not Donald Trump. Was that because Barack Obama's a Chicago guy, or because, like some other athletes, they said they do not want to go to a Donald Trump White House? Do you guys know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, these are very, very rich people, these baseball players. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them were Republicans.
And didn't Barack Obama say something like, you better get here quick? After the win, wasn't there? I think there was.
I don't remember that.
The Ricketts family would put a stall on that trip. Right.
It's kind of interesting, because the ownership is definitely for Trump, and maybe the players, I would guess, are not for Trump. Ticket prices go up 19.5%. You guys saw that coming, I guess.
Kristen is heartbroken.
A ticket.
More Sox
make
fans.
It easier for Kristen to continue to not go to Cubs games, I guess. But I guess that's fair, huh, guys? They'll still sell out, maybe to corporations and rich people, but all those seats will be taken.
I don't think families have been going to Major League Baseball games for a long time. So
I'll just keep being down with the 99%ers at Sox Park while you guys all, fuss around with your 1%ers.
They actually pay you now to go to Sox Park on three nights a year.
I know this isn't
a sports podcast. I don't want to put you on the spot, but what do you make of these trades that the White Sox have made?
They're overdue. I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking to see some of these players like Chris Sale, who I really like, but he was carrying the team, and they needed to have, a blue light special on the White Sox, and that's what they've done. And so I don't want to get my hopes up, but the prospects look pretty good.
Yeah, I'd get the value for him while I can. He wasn't enough to hold the team up, so go ahead and get something for him, right, Kristen?
Exactly.
Let's do our recommendations, guys. Things that you are reading, watching, listening to, or eating, or drinking. Who wants to go first? Mr. Bertrand, do you have a recommendation for us?
I am very excited I'm going to pre-recommend the third season of Mozart in the Jungle. Do you drop TV seasons? It's dropping this weekend on Amazon. It's the reason I got Amazon Prime to watch it in the first place, the first two seasons, and I'm more excited than when Steve Martin was releasing his Let's Get Small album in the mid-70s.
Wow. Wow. I don't know if I can follow that.
I watched the premiere, the debut episode of that, and it didn't grab me.
Okay, let me give you the most loathed sentence. Oh, you got to give it four or five episodes, right? That's what everyone says about their TV show.
All right.
How about you, Eric? What are you liking this week?
Johanna and I went to see Moonlight over the weekend, a sort of indie film about a young African-American boy growing up in the projects in Miami. And it has three chapters in his life, when he's about 8 years old, then when he's a high school student, like a sophomore in high school, and then when he's an adult man. He's gay. And just the world that it shows you, it's a very powerful movie. I really recommend it.
Kristen, what do you like?
I want everyone to go to the Chicago Tribune website and go to Suffering in Secret. It was a series that our newsroom did on group homes for the adult disabled in this state. There's a video attached to, I think, the second installment of a mother with an adult disabled son, and they actually have footage inside one of these group homes, and it's just absolutely gripping. It exposes you to something you might not expect or understand about parents who have special needs kids and that fierce bond that they have. Watch it. It's a 5-minute video, and it's worth your time.
And will I be sad, or will I be uplifted by what I see?
You'll be touched. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
It's tender.
Well, I would say touch is the way to describe Manchester by the Sea, the new Casey Affleck, Michelle Williams, etc. It's got a great cast. Some people you don't know, some you'll certainly recognize. Oh, Lord, there's some great actors in this movie and acting. And you know, it's this really dark, harrowing story about a kind of a loner guy who now has to raise his nephew, and he doesn't want to do it. And you know, it's kind of a tough movie to watch. What was surprising to me is how funny it is. When the two of them begin to forge a relationship, it's sarcastic, and it's quick, and it's really funny, too. The movie is not a comedy. Don't go into it for laughs, but you get some comic relief. And it's the best movie I've seen this year, that's for sure.
Zorn Williams at the movies this week, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. Manchester by the Sea for me. Thank you, Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie. Nice to hear your voice in the podcast again. Steve Bertrand, the same to you. I'm John Williams. Thanks to our engineer, Ben Cortez, did it this week. And our producer is Kristen Decker. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!